You must tell me all your secrets. Remember, we must share everything together.
At the door.
And now a knock at the door.
Sandy is still out in the car. And here enters Frank. So Dorothy makes Jeffrey get back in the closet. She's like, I'll kill you if you make any noise. I swear.
Does she say, I kill you, I'll kill you, or he'll kill you?
Oh, I thought it was I'll kill you, but.
Well, we'd have to watch back because today I was watching it again and I was like, was that he'll kill you? I swear. I'm like, oh, God, we would all be so lucky to be torn up by Dorothy Valens.
Totally.
Kill me, mommy. Kill me, mommy. And then Frank comes in and she's like, hello, sir. And he goes, it's daddy, you shithead.
Oh, no, she goes, hello, baby.
Oh, hello, baby. That's
yeah,
right.
She goes, hello, baby. And he goes, it's daddy, you shithead. Like, she should just know what headspace he's in.
Right.
He's in this leather and Western wear shirt. I mean, he very much looks like Dennis Hopper, Easy Rider.
Mm.
But he also looks like this very iconic, like, 60s bad guy.
Yeah. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous fit, too.
Yeah. Dennis Hopper plays this perfectly.
He totally does.
He immediately takes control of her. He tells her to spread her legs. Isabella was actually naked under that robe when they filmed it, and Dennis Hopper had no idea. So when he gets in front of her and she spread her legs, he was like, and there was her vagina. She was very nervous to film it, but he was like, you know, it's nothing I haven't seen before.
And she says and that was in the documentary.
Yeah, she said it was comforting.
Yeah, she was like, that calmed me down, that he was, you know, he was blasé about it.
Yeah.
This guy's like, listen, I've done some shit. It's fine. It's a pussy. And it's Isabella Rossellini's pussy. Come on.
Right. He's so lucky.
He's so fucking lucky. Jesus Christ.
And he's crazy. Frank Booth is crazy.
He's nuts.
Yeah. He's like, don't you fucking look at me. He's huffing nitrous oxide like a baby sucking on a teat.
Well, I feel I wrote nitrous oxide in the.
But is it amyl nitrate?
It's amyl nitrate.
Okay, so he's actually huffing amyl nitrate,
which he was at his suggestion because they originally were going to have him be huffing helium.
Yeah,
And it kind of would play into this like baby aspect of his speaking voice when he.
But
goes
it doesn't.
Baby
it wouldn't
mode.
Get you high.
It wouldn't get you high. And amyl nitrate. Dennis was like, "Well, amyl nitrate gets you fucking high and makes you horny." And I'm like, God bless drug users. And I mean that entirely sincerely. Big support, truly. And also in this perverse knowledge is really like you just don't know these things unless you've lived those experiences. Mm-hmm. And I love that Dennis Hopper has that life experience.
Absolutely.
To know.
Yeah. So it's time for baby mode.
The amyl nitrate comes out, baby mode activated.
And Frank starts to, he has this very disturbing display where he goes into this headspace and he's calling, he's like, mommy, baby wants to fuck.
Baby wants to fuck.
This was insane to me when I saw it.
Yeah.
I was like, what the fuck am I supposed to make of this?
Right.
And now I understand it a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
He's switching into this baby headspace. And
from daddy to baby.
From
is
daddy
so
to baby. Yeah, exactly. And there's a familiarity here with kink terminology as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah.
I don't know if David Lynch was actually familiar with it, but it certainly reads like he is.
Yeah.
Of daddy being the dominant role and baby being the submissive role. But this is a very dominant baby.
Yes. This is a fucked up baby. This baby is power hungry and vindictive, which is something that I really, if I could speak personally, it's actually something that I really relate to.
Vindictive baby.
A vindictive baby or like power hungry baby that is, you know, looking to flip, looking to be very insolent, as it were, on a bad day. But it's
and yeah. abuse mommy.
And yes. Yay. On occasion, if mommy too were to take a couple pills, you know, you never know what's going to happen in the evening.
Dorothy Valance is definitely a mommy archetype that I can get down with and embody sometimes if I'm feeling my abused, submissive oats.
Yeah.
Abused mommy is definitely something I can get down with.
Well, we talked about recreating this scene as a...
as a kink scene.
As a kink scene, which would be wonderful. And I feel like it would be cool to... It would be interesting to combine both Jeffrey and Frank, like, this character. Because I love... you know me. I love a closet. I love a scene that starts in a closet and this voyeuristic watching. And then transforms into baby wanting to fuck.
Baby wants to fuck. Atkinson says, between Frank, Dorothy, and Jeffrey, Blue Velvet digs at a primordial truth about human emotional need, the horrified frustrations that plague us if our needs are not met, and the subterranean knots those frustrations bind up inside of us. In this world, the pure anger of a neglected baby can poison the very air.
Oh, yeah. Neglected baby. I'm like, Frank, it's funny because I don't think of Frank at all as a neglected baby.
Well, he also says that this film pulses with empathy for him, which I don't agree with.
I don't agree with whatsoever. That's an interesting read of that. I wouldn't agree with that pretty much at all. I feel like Frank is portrayed as this like really awful person. He's meant to be disturbing. I think there's like an element of like you can perhaps relate to this kind of dark-sided humanity that he has.
He's, I think, like, he's Jeffrey's like id.
Like
he's the worst parts of him.
Yes, he's the dark, moist, damp nasties that live inside.
Yeah.
He is the subterranean. He's in the soil.
Exactly. Absolutely. So Frank punches Dorothy in the face and he's like, don't you fucking look at me. And she gives this Isabel Rossellini gives this incredible performance here where she turns her head and with the force of the punch, and she's got this blissed out look on her face.
Yeah.
And this is one of the scenes that some feminist writers really hated at the time.
Yeah.
Because she is portrayed as enjoying her abuse. What do you think?
Well, I think that having some knowledge and like experience, you know, like I've met and am friends with many people that have experienced sexual trauma and sexual abuse, and I think one of the most common things that happens with any kind of like recurring, especially sexual abuse, is a kind of Stockholm syndrome where, like, in order to get through it, you begin to enjoy it.
The body protects you.
It naturally does that. That's a normal, that's like a completely normal documented thing that happens. It's literally a defense mechanism. So her enjoying it on first watch, I think it's just disturbing. You're like confused. You don't know what's going on, but like this has been going on for quite some time. She's being continually violently abused by Frank.
And I also love that she's this imperfect victim. She's a mother. She's lives in abject poverty. She's a singer at the sleazy lounge. She's portrayed as, like Atkinson says, as this kind of like aging harlot figure. And she is so scared of him, but she also asks Jeffrey to hit her. I mean,
right.
I think, like you said, I think that she's finding these, there's tension there. Like she's gleaning erotic enjoyment and slipping into a different space, slipping into like almost a subspace.
Yeah.
When she's experiencing this.
Totally. I think about this aspect of Dorothy's character, and it immediately reminds me of Laura Palmer and the idea of an imperfect victim and like someone who suffers prolonged, extended abuse, particularly sexual abuse, will take on different characteristics to protect themselves. And like your psyche will literally change to make life bearable. And as we see, well, we'll get to that, but like,
well, Lynch is also so interested in the psyche and the subconscious and the way that we take, it's very Jungian too, like the way that we our dreams are manifestations of our unconscious desires, or the way that we fixate on certain things and then they become sexual fetishes. Like we fixate on them in childhood and then we just become like fixated on them as sexual experiences.
Yeah.
And I think that that's more so what it speaks to than saying, oh, women just want to be abused.
Totally.
I think it speaks to the changing of the psyche, the molding of the psyche, and also like the way that things can be both awful and exciting, and nothing is ever one thing.
Most definitely.
So she is putting the blue velvet robe in his mouth. He's like, baby wants blue velvet. So she shoves it in his mouth. He's like groaning pathetically.
He's sucking on it.
Yeah. He takes these scissors and he's threatening mommy. And of course that's scary because we know that the ear was cut off with scissors.
Exactly.
And he just becomes completely psychotic.
He's in a reverie.
Yeah, he's in a reverie. And he shoves the blue velvet robe in her mouth, but he's also like shoves it in her pussy.
Yeah.
Like he takes it and he's, you know, we see from Jeffrey's angle that he's like shoving it inside of her.
The blue velvet umbilical cord.
Yes, the umbilical cord.
Yes, yes, mommy. The umbilical
cord. And it's also speaks to you know, again, those Jungian sort of unconscious symbolic desires of, you know, Frank must have imprinted on this blue velvet at some point as a child, and it's now become the sexual obsession.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously this whole movie is, you know, the Freudian analysis is like so clearly there, but I really don't think it gets to the meat of of what you're talking about. I do think that actually, yeah, Jungian perspective is a much more kind of like in-depth way to analyze this through that lens.
Well, it's definitely also Freudian, right? Because this is a primal scene.
The primal scene.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know, the primal scene is what that's what Freud would call a child walking in on their parents having sex. And that's the primal scene, and it's like traumatic for the kid and creates these pathologies, these sexual pathologies.
Right.
So Frank doesn't even, in the legal definition of the word, rape Dorothy, because he just humps her like violently until he comes. You never see him take his cock out. You never see him like unzip anything. He just like becomes frenzied, and then he just like humps away at her until he's spent.
So violently.
So it was violently, so... but like a little kid.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I've seen like a three-year-old one time that was babying this fucking three-year-old, and he did the same kind of humping motion, this like, and you're like, ah, stop. Like, it's so disturbed. You're like, you're literally not supposed to stop that. Like, and also as an aside, I will say I'm very impressed by how quickly Frank can get into subspace.
It's that amyl nitrate.
It's that amyl nitrate buying right now. No, but he really, like, this guy knows what his perversions are, and he is dedicated to them, which is something I really have to respect about Frank's character, is this kind of, like, psychotic obsession with his perversions, that he is entirely, his whole life is dedicated to it.
It's ritualized. It's heavily ritualized.
He's obsessed. He's taken, simply.
I relate to that.
I do too. It's almost inspiring in a fucked up way.
Yeah.
Like, Herbert's watching this taking notes. It's just that you do it with lots of negotiation, consent, and care.
Trust, and yeah, all of those things, all of those course. Things. Don't cancel us.
Like, Frank Booth is so cool. He's awesome. I love him.
Atkinson says that Isabella Rossellini's acquiescent role as the defiled mommy in Frank's gnashing psychodrama may be her half-conscious way of trying to prevent the generation of a new Frank Booth. Like, she has taken on his sins almost to, like, and she, I mean, she's very acquiescent.
Yeah.
But she's acquiescent because he has her kid and husband.
Right. And he's threatening to kill her as well. Yeah. Like, yeah, it makes sense that, I don't know, she's like, she herself is imprinting. She's not immune from these kinds of...
She's part of the ritual now.
Totally.
And she is almost like without a self in this movie because she's so inducted into this ritual. And I think it's much more interesting than, oh, you know, women like abuse. I think it's about getting caught up with this other person's psyche. Herself has fallen away.
Yes.
You know, she's like in this, the void of the ear.
Oh,
she's no longer has selfhood. It's all Frank has replaced it.
Well, which could be, you know, it makes sense that,
which is what happens to a mother.
Right. Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. And it makes sense that people's read of that, especially at the time, was like, well, this is not a feminist perspective. And like, she has no agency. And I'm like, you're right. She does have no agency. She's being forced. You know,
yes.
It's a part of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Frank stands over her after this, you know, he's back to being Sir. And he, you know, he says, stay alive, baby. Do it for Van Gogh. Van Gogh, reference to the missing ear. That's our clue that the ear was her kidnapped husband. And he says, when he enters the scene and turns out a light, he says, now it's dark. And then he does it again at the end of this rape. And he says, now it's dark. And that was actually a mantra that was improvised by Dennis Hopper.
I didn't realize that was improvised.
Yeah. So Jeffrey watched the whole thing through the closet. This is obviously like the fucked up primal scene, the daddy and the mommy fucking in front of the baby.
Yeah.
Atkinson says, Jeffrey watching quietly in the dark is us, the audience, and our movies are our collective primal scenes. Mm. And that the forced dialogue of the scene, the bizarre and impotent mockery of sex it portrays, and the fearsome weirdness of Frank's chaotic utterances smacks of the scrambling, terrified images conjured by a child listening to his parents making love. I definitely think that Freudian element is there.
Totally. Well, and I'm also like, God, what were Freud's parents doing when they were fucking? Because you know what? I grew up with artist parents. Like, my mom's a photographer. My dad was a painter and a sculptor. Like, there were pictures of my dad's penis hanging in our house. Like, my mother was like this artful photograph that she developed in our dark room, our house dark room.
Yeah.
Like, there was like a
certain... Kids with artist parents were different. When I heard my parents having sex, I was like, he's hurting mommy. So I can understand this.
Yeah, so there was my perspective of, I'm like, well, they're having sex. They've got genitals. Like, it was, I mean, it's so Northern California.
Yeah, totally.
Like, yeah, and my mother, you know, like, specifically my mother being this very free, open artist, like, my perspective was very different, for sure, on sex. But I'm like, Freud's parents were, like, I don't know, his mother was getting nailed to the cross or something.
I know. I mean, I definitely thought that my dad was hurting my mom.
And guess what he was? Just kidding. Kidding.
No, kidding, Lorraine. That was
this. Oh, I'm sorry. I never met you.
Yeah, I think a lot of kids think that.
Yeah.
When they hear their parents having sex. So I think that there is something here to that.
Oh, definitely.
So Jeffrey emerges from the closet to comfort Dorothy, and she is comforted by him and wants him to be attracted to her and feel her, unlike Frank, or perhaps just like him.
Mm-hmm.
She, you said, Car, she's low-key in subspace.
That's so annoying. She's low-key in subspace. No, she, yeah, well, the space that she's in is it totally disattached, is what I would say. Like, she's like, She's changed into something entirely different, especially given the fact that, like, she was just about to attack and hurt Jeffrey. She's now this, like, submissive animal. Like, she's just, like, definitely, she's like desperate. She's become mm-hmm. desperate very quickly after this insane encounter.
Yeah, and she's like asking, she's like, do you like me? And she's like, you know, hit me. And he's like, no, I want to help you.
Yeah.
He has no idea what to do with her.
He's deeply confused. I mean, I would be too, you know.
Yeah.
When you don't know.
She doesn't want him to leave. And he looks at the picture underneath the couch, and it's a picture of her husband and son, Don and Donnie.
Mm.
And Dorothy whispers, help me. And I think she means, like, help her to both drop back into the space, but also to take her out of it, to exorcise the demons, to sink deeper into the void, but also to be lifted out of it before she loses herself entirely. And like, isn't that just that delicious feeling of like being on the edge of the void, of like you could completely lose yourself? Like, help me sink into that, help me get back there, but also like don't let me go.
Right. Yeah, that's a really interesting read of that. I like that interpretation of that, especially because, you know, like she's experiencing this fucked up sort of dalliance with Frank, but then it would make sense to want to transfer that experience into something entirely different, whether or not it's it mirrors the abuse that she's experiencing. It's her way. It can be a way of reclaiming that, especially since she's now, her body is enjoying it. Like her body is telling her something different than her mind, and she wants to put the two together. It seems.
Right.
I think that's a really interesting read on that.
So Jeffrey is quite disturbed. He that night has dreams, which is these images of his ailing father and Frank intertwined. Obviously, you know, the connection between daddy and father, very potent here. He hears Dorothy say, hit me. And he sees himself in Dorothy's position getting punched by Frank, which is very gender fucked.
Yeah.
And he's like developing this real, you know, she's starting to become like a whole person to him.
Yeah. Because he's relating.
Yeah.
And also it makes sense that he's relating when she's put him in a similar position. Like their first meeting is him in this position that she's putting him in, that she's experienced in a way.
So Jeffrey wakes up and he has this zoom in on this very odd token hanging above his bed, which looks like fucked up teeth and gums and a tongue.
And we noticed that on our like second watch through.
Michael Atkinson doesn't know what that is either.
I know, like
nobody
what is that?
Knows what that is.
We'll have to call Lynch after this. We're close personal friends.
Is this at the hardware store where the blind man sells an axe to a lumberjack?
Yeah. Just like a little blip. Yeah. You know? It's just more Americana, like enjoy love.
Enjoy love. Jeffrey picks up Sandy. She wants to know what happened. She's none the wiser. Jeffrey, of course, doesn't tell her exactly what happened.
He does not tell her that he fucked mommy.
And he says, but he does say, I think she wants to die.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells Sandy, you know, what he thinks is happening, which is that Frank is sexually obsessed with Dorothy and he's kidnapped her son and husband and is holding her hostage in this way. And he cut off the husband's ear as a warning for her to stay alive and not kill herself.
Yeah.
Frank is, you know, he's like, this is a very dangerous man. Mm-hmm. You wrote that he's a precursor to somebody like Bob from Twin Peaks.
Yeah. I think there's, well, I guess if we're talking too about like the shadow self, like Frank is, you can interpret Frank as a shadow self of Jeffrey. You could interpret Frank as a shadow self of his own self. You know, we see Frank as one thing in this. We don't know who Frank was before. The only time we get a glimpse of kind of emotional, like a different emotional space for Frank is when later on in the film, when the In Dreams song is happening and he starts to get emotional and teary-eyed and you're like, what's happening here?
You know? And also there's another scene where he's at the club and he's crying.
Yeah, where you're like, damn, dog, what happened?
Yeah, well, I think that's what Michael Atkinson thinks, that the film has empathy for him.
I see. Well, it's like, you know, him crying doesn't mean you have to have empathy for him. It's in my read of it, I'm like, you pathetic little fuck. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I also have that reaction to men crying, period. for many reasons. yeah, like this idea of the shadow self, and clearly Bob, to me, in Twin Peaks, is this either dream world or shadow figure, this evil creature that is just embodying evil. And I feel like Frank embodies evil in this film. And I think that David Lynch is very interested in a very extreme example of evil in a lot of his works. Things and people that are clearly like bad, violent, scary, disturbing. And he's also like the most, to me, Frank is the most engaging character in this film. He's like, he comes on screen and you can't really focus on anything else. He's like this whirlwind of a character.
Yeah. Pulls absolutely.
You in. And that's a testament to Dennis Hopper's performance too. He just really fucking rip-roared this thing through. Like,
he really did.
He did that.
He fucking slayed. He put his whole hot pussy into that.
His hot pussy. His Dennis-y fully.
Jeffrey says, why are there people like Frank? And you said, so we can all jerk off, you sick fuck.
Sorry. Baby wants to fuck.
Sandy talks about this dream she had where she's like, there's our world and you know, the robins. It confuses me, to be honest.
About robins, a dark world.
Yeah, she's like, there's a dark world and then it, you know, it opens and there's this robin and it symbolizes all this love. And
yeah, and the robins come down and then they were all flying down and
yeah. There
was light. And you're like, you're this little girl, like this little girl, teenage girl's explanation to you. It's very sweet as well. Like Sandy being like, there is love.
Yeah. And you know. Yeah. And robins do symbolize love and peace.
Tranquility.
I looked it up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He says, you're a neat girl, Sandy. And she says, so are you. I mean, you're a neat boy.
Yeah. Oh, that's cute. I know his little look. I'm like, okay, so we have an egg on our hands. I always pray for that.
Jeffrey returns to Dorothy. Mommy is still not okay. She's confused why he's back. She's like, I looked for you in the closet tonight.
Love that.
And he's got, you said he's got his hot high school little baby girl and his mommy. And I said that that's the adult world versus his childhood world.
Well, you're a lot smarter than me.
Back at the slow club, Mommy sings again, and we see Frank there. He's such a fetishist, holding a square of blue velvet, and he's crying as Dorothy sings. This is the scene where Atkinson suggests that this film has a lot of empathy for Frank. I'm not sure if I agree with that. I think we are meant to identify with, like, be disturbed and identify with him and just feel because I don't feel empathy for him at all, but that could just be me. I don't feel that I need Frank's backstory. I like it this way.
Yeah.
You know, I like that we know something.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to necessarily be something traumatic.
Well, I also don't think that pure evil, I think oftentimes the most evil things are, most evil people have a wide breadth of emotion and can be very often seen as a victim and have this highly emotional aspect to them. And if you're not seeing them in their evil moments of, you know, for Frank, it's this, you know, ritualistic rape and abuse of this woman and murder. Clearly, he doesn't give a fuck about kidnapping a child, cutting the ear off of someone. You know, I think that it is a very accurate portrayal of the way evil functions. It can be very asinine. It can be very benign seeming. You can almost feel empathy. Oh, he's crying. Like, but that's the true banality of evil, quote unquote, there. Like, and I think my perspective on that is so peppered by having, you know, known specific men in my life at points or another that part of the most fucked up parts of their like abuse and the way they are and the way they move through the world is the fact that they're very emotional and
yes,
are highly highly victimized themselves and portray themselves as a victim to others. It's danger. It's more dangerous.
Well, I'm thinking about Lolita.
Yeah.
And in Lolita, Humbert, his origin story is that when he's 12, he falls in love with his first love and they never get to consummate the relationship. And that's like a trauma for him where he imprints, I know, where he imprints on 12-year-old girls. And that's what I mean. That's kind of what I'm getting at is like, it doesn't necessarily have to be that something horrible happened to him.
Yeah.
He's just imprinted on something that he's transmuted by a combination of nurture and nature.
Yeah.
Into this insane psychosexual fascination and obsession. It doesn't necessarily have to be that Frank was like abused or something.
Right.
It can just be an imprint and a nostalgia for a childhood.
Mm. Totally. I really agree with that. I think the Atkinson's, perhaps Atkinson's read on that is probably informed by his own sympathy towards men and towards himself.
Yeah.
Specifically. He's like, we have to empathize with him because he's crying and he's emotional and he's a baby. And so am I. And that's what men are like, men so often. Obviously, I'm just generalizing here, yada, yada, yada. But like, this kind of like powerful baby perspective that is deeply violent and deeply entitled.
Babies are incredibly entitled.
They are. Oh my God. I'm like, you're so hungry. Shut up. I'm working. Oh my God.
Babies are incredibly entitled and they have a right to be because they need to survive.
Exactly.
But a person who is still in that baby space, that entitled baby space, is toxic.
Yes. Yeah. But that, I mean, that's like, you could really go into as well, like the dichotomy of people, like kink play, like people playing as babies and people playing as mommies, daddies, whatever adult figure. And why it's it can be so healing to, you know, engage in both age play or even just on a less like, highly involved level of kink, like the prevalence of using the words mommy and daddy and like baby girl, baby boy, like it's their vehicles for like
our playing with power.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Power exchange and power play. And like when it becomes real, like it is, yeah, this entitlement, like the baby, this violent baby with so much power being so entitled is so dangerous and is something I just heavily relate to in my life experiences, actually.
Like, totally.
I've encountered so many people like that.
We leave the bar. Jeffrey's really getting himself into this world that he doesn't know anything about. And is this when... So we see Frank's... You see Frank's name on an office suite?
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell me what happens in the scene?
Yeah, so Jeffrey follows, he's following Frank at some, this is when he goes to, I believe this is like the next day. So he's basically, Jeffrey's like wanting to get more intel about Frank. He follows him to where he goes. He goes to this industrial brick building, more Lynch factories, industry. He's just trying to get intel on Frank. He then ends up, you know, we see that Frank's name is on an office suite, that he works in the lumber industry. We see the yellow man come and meet Frank Booth here. This is where Jeffrey has his little shoebox camera in his car that he's taking a picture of. I'm like, girl, no one can see you. You don't need a shoebox camera. But it's a wonderful detail. It's very, like, I also think David Lynch is, he must have been like, I'm going to be a spy when he was a kid.
Yeah.
Which I heavily relate to. I had a lot of spy gear. I loved spying. I wiretapped my neighbor's house one time. They were horrible people. Their son, they were like these terrible Republicans. Their son once shot, I grew up in a woodsy area, and their son once shot at me in the backyard and said, don't look like a deer, we'll shoot you with BB guns. Anyway, it was awesome. I loved it. So he's following close behind. He's spying. He's like in his detective oats. Mm-hmm. And so he gathers this intel here.
And then he picks up Sandy from high school, and Sandy's boyfriend Mike is not happy about Jeffrey picking her up.
No, no, no.
Same name as the football player in Twin Peaks.
Yeah, football player Mike.
So Sandy and Jeffrey are in the diner again. They're talking about what Jeffrey found out, and he says he staked out Frank. He's like, there's this guy in a yellow suit I call the Yellow Man, and he's Frank's accomplice. The Yellow Man walked out and met a well-dressed man holding an alligator briefcase. Then Jeffrey says, and then there was this murder that happened, right down the street.
Right.
A drug dealer was killed, and a woman was shot.
And her legs, yeah, her legs are broken. We see the shot of this woman with her all...
Her legs are broken, yeah. And we never really find out, actually, in the film what was going on here.
Right.
Which I like.
Yeah.
There's intrigue, but it's blue balled. Like, you never really find out
right. What
was happening. And he's really enjoying his little detective life. He's got his day life and his night life, his girl of the day and his lady of the night.
Yeah. And his girl back home, which we don't even know about, but now we do.
So back at mommy's place.
Back in mommy's place, he's smitten. They start making out immediately. It's like this very immediate, you know, this immediate pull, like a mother and a son. It's completely primal. It's actually natural. It's good. It's better. they need each other. You know, they're on these. They go to the blue satin sheets. I wrote here, wonder if he's ever had sex. This is his first time.
Yeah.
Cause
I have no idea. Like that was something I was wondering too, is his first time with Dorothy, or has he had sex before? We don't know.
I wonder. I really wonder. I mean, the cut scenes kind of make me think, oh no, he's probably had sex before. He thinks he's all that, you know, his little earring, et cetera.
Yeah.
I'm like, but has he ever been fucked in the ass? That's the real question.
Because until you've done that, you've never really had sex.
That's
why. As a man.
As
you've
man.
Never been fucked in the ass, you're a virgin.
Sorry to tell you, but it's true. She asks, Dorothy asks, are you a bad boy? I said, Mommy, stop.
I know, it's really hot.
It is.
She begs him to hit her again. Mm. And he's like, no. And then she's like, get out.
Yeah.
And he's so incensed that he slaps her twice.
He's like, you ask baby to leave? Never.
And he slaps her twice, and it lets out this beast, and you hear these like bestial, like animal sounds as he like fucks her into the blue satin sheets.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a great scene.
You're like, oh, he's becoming a man. Like,
yeah, and
something
to become
changes.
A man is to become an abuser.
Literally.
Yeah. I mean, he's living out his worst impulses.
Yeah.
Atkinson says he's got to experience the deviant nightmare of the primal scene he witnessed in order to gain experience. What we're on to here is the idea of sex itself being essentially symbolic of a larger, more pervasive passage, mainly our necessary corruption and the loss of childhood ignorance. And since the film's universe is hyperbolized, so must it be its carnal ordeal.
Mm.
He's passing over into another state of being, indulging his worse Frank-like personality traits.
His shadow self, if one will. Mm-hmm. He's giving in to that, these urges.
And Dorothy looks like in rapture.
She loves it. She's ecstatic. You see her chipped little tooth and her ecstatic grin. And she's like, It's also like, to me, it's like this, you know, the mother and son reunited in a way.
Yes.
You know, reunited in his manhood. Like, he's no longer a boy. He can come to mother on the same level.
He's baby and husband.
As so many men and boys are to their mothers.
And, you know, the husband's name is Don and the little boy's name is Donnie. So, of course, there's connection there between husband and son. But then also Isabella calls Jeffrey Don and Donnie.
That's right.
So he goes back and forth in this mode.
Her husband's son.
Yeah. She says to him, I still have you inside me. It helps me. I need you.
Yes. God.
I know.
Stop.
Isabella.
Isabella, you have to stop. What do you mean you have what inside you? What part of him? What are you saying?
So as Jeffrey leaves, Frank and his boys show up in the hallway, and they're not happy about this boy from the neighborhood courting mommy. Frank is like, you want to go for a joyride? Doesn't take no for an answer.
Of course not.
They're in the car, right? And he, you know, he's like, he's our pussy. It's so homoerotic. He's like, you ever been to pussy heaven?
And I'm like, yes, I have. Oh my God, Frank.
Yeah, Raymond, played by Brad Dourif, pulls out a little switchblade. And, you know, all of this degradation that's happening from Frank to Jeffrey, it's like this violent homosexual threat to Jeffrey. He's subjected to a number of symbolic rapes. In the original script, Dorothy threatens Jeffrey with the prospect of Frank opening him. Should have kept that in there.
Well, that's interesting too. Right after he has this symbolic kind of like opening into manhood, he's immediately degraded back into being a boy. I feel like he's going through this like empowerment. He's like, oh my God, I'm a man. I'm kind of like living out this fantasy. I'm gaining this experience. I'm becoming something different than what I was. And it's exciting and powerful. And then he's immediately put back in his place and taken down further by the ultimate baby daddy.
And feminized, yes. As Frank even feminizes himself later.
Totally.
We get to another one of my favorite parts of the movie, which is with the Dean Stockwell character. There's another reference to beer where Frank is like, you know, what do you drink? And Jeffrey's like, Heineken. And Frank's like, fuck that shit. Pabst Blue Ribbon! They get to this pink parlor salon with this motley cast of characters. It feels like very John Waters.
Totally.
Ensemble. There's fat women, which of course always makes me think of John Waters. Jack Nance is also part of Frank's crew.
That's who
is in Twin Peaks, and he's also in Eraserhead. He's in like every David Lynch movie.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. Frank is, he loves Ben. Ben is played by Dean Stockwell. He's the fabulous plug. Yes. Dean Stockwell was a child actor. He had a comeback, prolific child actor, and then he had a comeback in the 1960s in the New Hollywood movement, contemporary of Dennis Hopper. And he plays this part here as like very effeminate and polymorphously perverse. He's very fey.
He's slithering around.
Yeah.
He's calm.
I love his performance in this.
I do too.
Here's to your fuck, Frank.
He's also very much blasé about Frank. He's not fazed by Frank. He knows this man. He knows how unpredictable he is. And he, in this classic kind of plug way too, he's like, never mind you. I know what's going on and I know what baby wants. You know? He's like, I've got the goods. You relax, Frank. I'll get it for you. Get Frank a beer.
Yeah.
And Frank's like, yeah, a beer.
He's like, man, you're so suave.
He like loves him.
Yeah. He's like, we love Ben.
Like, you're on drugs, sir.
Daddy. This is how I feel when I'm talking to the drug dealer.
I know, like,
we love her.
We love her so much. Oh my God, you're so cool.
And he also Ben and Frank go to the side, and Ben pops like a little mystery pill in Frank's mouth. And there's some like, Frank says something about like, oh, you know, they got him good, you know, because he's the man. And he took all those drugs out of there. Yeah. And Jeffrey's like listening. There's also a moment where, which is pretty funny, where Frank punches Jeffrey in the face, and then Ben is like, did he hurt your face? And he punches him in the gut.
It's so good. I'm like, beat that twig. Beat that twig. Oh, and also when Frank pops that pill that that Ben gives him, he's like bragging about his little thing, his drug bust, whatever, and then he goes, a candy colored clown. They call the Sandman.
And Ben knows what's good. He like is, he knows this guy.
He's Mother Superior here.
Yeah.
He definitely has that air to him.
He reminds me of in Daughters of Darkness when the husband calls Mother, and it's this like queenie guy who's like, Mother sends her regards.
Yes.
Like he's the queen.
And he reminds me of the dealer.
Yeah, he presides.
Yeah.
He reminds me of the dealer in Trainspotting, actually, who's referred to as Mother Superior.
Ah, you know,
it's all coming together.
There's these kinds of characters. I'm like the benevolent plug.
Yeah. And he's also surrounded by these fat women. Yes. Like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
So Dorothy is reunited with her son. This is like a section of the movie where Frank is calling her tits. He's like, let tits see your kid. Like just completely objectifying her.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey hears her in the other room, and she's like, Dottie, no, mommy loves you. Oh. Like something terrible has happened to the kid.
Yeah.
We have no idea what it is. Ben, suddenly, with a light as a microphone.
He flips the switch.
It's fabulous. And he gives this gorgeous performance to In Dreams by Roy Orbison.
It's an iconic scene. Truly iconic. He's lip syncing. I'm like, diva, please. You are incredible. He is the queen. He's like, I know what these girls want. It's a lip sync, bitch.
Yeah.
And he's got a cigarette in his mouth. In his little ciggy holder. And it's just so, to me, this like industrial light is a microphone. Like he's got this clowny white makeup on his face. It's equally as this scene to me was as disturbing to watch when I first saw it as the baby wants to fuck scene, the first rape scene, like because of how kind of weird and uncanny and seemingly out of place it is, like in the story. And then the more times I've watched it, I can see the comedy in this sequence, but it still is very disturbed, you know.
And makeup is a big theme in David Lynch's work as well. You think of Robert Blake in Lost Highway when he's got that crazy white clownish sort of makeup on, and
love.
In Mulholland Drive where Rebecca Del Rio has that makeup on when she's singing, when she's lip syncing to her own voice. Again, very much recalling Wizard of Oz, where Judy Garland is lip-syncing to her own voice. David Lynch is very interested in this kind of, like, delusion artifice. And I always hate when Frank cuts off Ben. Like, he starts getting emotional, and Ben can tell, like, okay, we're done here.
Right. Because he knows what happens when Frank gets emotional.
Yeah. And Frank is getting very emotional with this song. So this is another one of his, like, trigger songs, like Blue Velvet.
The candy-colored clown they call the Sandman tiptoes to my room every night just to sprinkle stardust and to whispers, go to sleep, everything is all right. I close my eyes and I drip away,
whatever,
into the magic night. I softly say a silent prayer like dreamers do, Then I fall asleep to dreams, my dreams of you. In dreams, I walk with you. In dreams, I talk to you. In dreams, you're mine. All the time we're together. In dreams, but just before the dawn, I awake and find you gone. I can't help it, I can't help it. If I cry, I remember that you said goodbye. It's too bad that all
we're still going.
These things can only happen in my dreams. Only in dreams, in beautiful dreams.
Thank you. That was Mommy and the Baby Girl Dancers.
That's right. That was Mommy and the Baby Girl Dancers.
We'll see. We'll see if that makes the cut.
God, I love that song.
I love that song too.
It's so, so good. Roy Orbison. I love David Lynch's taste in music, truly.
Yeah, absolutely. The pop song is a
symbol of the American psyche.
It's so rich. I love music in David Lynch movies.
Yeah.
It's, you know, write a whole thesis on that.
Totally. I can't help it if I cry. Frank. That's Frank right there.
Right. He's crying, and he's crying in this scene. He's getting emotional, and then he cuts the party short.
He's like, fuck
cuts
this.
Off Ben's performance, and he's like, let's fuck! I'll fuck anything that moves!
Me.
So, back on their joyride, he grabs one of the girls from from Ben's house on the joyride, which is, and then later she's going to be dancing on top of the car. And he's like, pulls over, he's threatening Jeffrey, he's huffing his amyl nitrate again, and he takes his mask away, and his eyes are really wide, and he looks at Jeffrey, and he's like, you're like me.
And Jeffrey's like, oh, fuck.
Jeffrey's so disturbed, and he's like, pawing at Dorothy. He's like, baby wants to fuck. And she's like, please, Frank, no. And he's like playing with her tits. And then Jeffrey is like, leave her alone. And defiantly, Frank pinches her tits really hard.
Ugh.
And Jeffrey fucking punches Frank in the face.
Yep.
And Frank is in disbelief. And they drag him out of the car. Frank, it's a very fucked up beating where Frank like smears lipstick on his face. Very much like the mom in Wild at Heart.
Mm.
And he's like putting his lipstick on and he's like, pretty, pretty. He's having his boys cue up In Dreams again.
Like, he's like, put on the song.
Put on the candy color clown they call the Sandman. And I love that he calls it that. It's very, it's childish. It's like what a kid would call a song if they didn't know the name.
Right.
They're like, the candy color clown. They
call- and, the most memorable part to them.
Right.
He's like, that's me. I'm the candy-colored clown.
Right. And Dorothy is like screaming as Daddy threatens her boy.
That's her baby boy, Daddy.
He's like, you know what a bullet in a love letter is, motherfucker? It's a bullet in the head, and you get a love letter from me. You're fucked.
And he kisses Jeffrey, like, mwah!
With
like,
the lipstick. It's, what do you like make of that kind of like, I mean, there's the Ben character who's queer, and then this also like kind of queered beating. Like, is this homophobic? Mm. Is this what is this? What's going on here?
Well, I think there's a couple, there's many different ways to interpret this scene. And I think that Frank is so muddled up in the head that, like, his way of asserting dominance with Jeffrey is like, he clearly senses that Jeffrey is in some way Dorothy's boy. Like, he knows. He's like, this good boy, huh? Like, he's, like, jealous. Like, he can't imagine a world where Dorothy has any kind of agency and any kind of interest in any man other than him. And he clearly has deep contempt for her husband and son. Like, that, he's like, that's my property. That's my mommy property. And him taking on this, like, feminine, I wouldn't even really call it feminine, but him like putting lipstick on and emasculating Jeffrey and making
and himself
like making him his pretty boy. I think it's his way of asserting dominance, as well as stepping into, he clearly thinks mommy has all this power, but he just wants to control mommy. And in some way, I guess he wants to be mommy perhaps.
Yeah.
Like,
I think it's like all of the roles becoming muddled.
Exactly. Like, that amyl nitrate, it does wonders.
if you want to feel like this.
Which I think we all do.
So poor Jeffrey gets beaten to shit. He wakes up beaten at the lumberyard and makes his way back home, and he's pondering on his bed, and he remembers Dorothy asking him to hit her, and he cries thinking about it.
Yes. Oh, wait, going back really quick, though, to the chick, the girl in the pink skirt dancing outside of the car. So Jeffrey's,
I know,
getting,
which Michael Atkinson, he's like this fat woman dancing on top of the car. She's not fat, by the way.
Girl.
She's just not skinny.
She's like completely just like
A standard size person with big toes.
Yeah. He's like, ugh, oy vey, these critics. But she's dancing outside of the car on this bridge, and she's got a total 50s look. She's like, she looks like she's at like the dance hop. She's like, I'm going there. She's like happy. I'm like, what's she on? Because I like it. I'll have what she's having.
Right.
She's completely but that's like such a Lynch character too, just to be this completely out of place, random chick enjoying herself.
Right.
While this meeting takes place.
Yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned her. So he's crying as he thinks about hitting Dorothy. He's in over his head. Jeffrey, he's still a boy. And like any good boy, he goes back to the detective. He's like, I know I'm in over my head now.
Yeah.
He calls Sandy on the phone, and she urges him to talk to her father. And he goes to the breakfast table. He's all beaten up, and Jeffrey's mother and aunt are at the breakfast table, and they look at his beaten face, and they're deeply concerned. And he's like, Aunt Barbara, respectfully, like, you're going to get it if you don't. Don't ask. So he goes to the police station, and he sees the man in the yellow suit.
He's a detective.
He goes to talk to Sandy's dad, and we find out that the yellow man is named Gordon, and the puzzle pieces are sort of coming together.
And he ends up leaving the station before he can talk to Sandy's father, because he's so taken aback.
Disconcerted, yeah. He goes back to Sandy's. And that's when he talks to her father, and he's showing her all the evidence. Detective Williams is disturbed seeing a man of the force in these photos with Frank, and he knows something that we don't, and we never really find out.
Right. Well, and I immediately think back to the very first scene when he's like, oh, you found an ear, did ya? I'm like, he knew that ear was there, or he knew an ear wouldn't. Like, there's a part of me that's like, this guy is in on it. When I've rewatched
Sinister.
It, because he's like such a fucking weirdo about it. He's like, a human ear, you say? Let's take a look. That's a human ear, all right. I'm like, stop being horny. Like, why are you talking like that? You know, in my read of it, I feel. In my own personal heart, I'd like to believe that Sandy's father is in on this.
He's in on the whole thing. So Jeffrey kind of goes back to his normal life. He's watering the lawn in his sunglasses. He visits his father in the hospital. Having given over the evidence to the police, he's rid of the spectacular plot for now. Jeffrey comes to pick Sandy up for a date. A cop car is parked outside their house, and to his surprise, he sees that Gordon, the yellow man, is at the house.
He pops in.
The detective, he warns Jeffrey not to blow it. He's like, don't blow this, Jeffrey. Like, he's like, don't worry, I'm on it.
So don't let him know what you know, brother.
The house party scene is weird. They go to this weird like high school house party, and mm-hmm. Sandy sees some friends who are clearly impressed with her college boyfriend. Julie Cruz plays The Mystery of Love. The Mystery of Love. Julie Cruz, R.I.P.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, her music is perfect for David Lynch movies because it's like an uncanny 60s sad lady, but not.
Yeah,
but
with this like 80s synth. Like, yeah. This ethereal synth in her music. She's amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, her music is so powerful and just beautiful.
Yeah, and so many of David Lynch's collaborators are dead now, like Julie Cruz and Angelo and Jack Nance. And
yeah.
I can understand why he would not feel like making movies.
Yeah, for sure.
Sandy and Jeffrey, they finally share a kiss and they say, I love you. And they make out on the dance floor. And it's very idyllic. This is in complete stark contrast to his trysts with Dorothy.
Right. And he's coming back to, he's like, ah, this normal calm life, like going back to what he knows, going back to this normal, you know, like what he's supposed to do sort of thing. It's very comforting to him for sure. And I'm like, this two-timing motherfucker, you're cheating on mommy?
You'll pay,
you insolent boy.
How dare you cheat on mommy?
How dare?
As they drive away, a car rushes to follow Jeffrey. It's black and chrome. It's a bad guy car. Jeffrey's like, it's Frank, and he says as he's being violated from behind. but it's actually Mike, which calms Jeffrey down. He's like, oh, thank God, it's only Mike.
Yeah.
The sexy cars are for perverted villains. He said the big black chrome and 50s car in Crash.
Yeah.
Contrast with Jeffrey's car, which is like a good guy car.
Yeah, it's all red and cool, sleek. I love a black and chrome 50s car. Elvira's,
yes,
you know, Dracula, like it's just like it's cool as hell.
It is cool as hell.
Cars. Like, why is Mike driving that? Get out of that.
They pull over in front of Jeffrey's house, and Mike is like, I'm gonna fuck you up.
He's got his boys with him.
But suddenly, Dorothy, naked and pale and covered in bruises, appears from the bushes in front of Jeffrey's house. And Mike is like, is that your mom?
Literally, I'm like, what's wrong with you? He's like barring Jeffrey from going to look at her, confront her at first and go help her. He's like, well, who's that? You're fucking sick. It's like, shut up. Oh my God.
Yeah. And then he feels bad about it. And she looks like battered.
Yes.
Abused. She's frail, pale,
ghostly.
Yeah. Sandy recognizes her.
And she just appears from nowhere, too. She appears from behind the bushes. I watched it back a couple times, too, to just see where she comes. She was clearly hiding in the bushes. She was waiting for Jeffrey to come home.
Isabella Rossellini said that this shoot, because they were shooting it in a small town, it became very popular for the inhabitants to come and, like, watch the scenes. And that there was all these people watching her film this. And she was like, all these people are like watching me naked.
Yeah.
And this like horrible scene. And I just can't imagine shooting under those conditions.
I know. That would be horrific. Like, I mean, especially for a young actress, this is her second film that she'd ever been in. And she's having to really just constantly be exposing herself. And the performance she gives here is just spectacular to me. Like, I in preparation for this show, I was, you know, listening to multiple like podcast reviews of Blue Velvet. And there was one reviewer that I won't name that commented on her performance being like, she's no real actress. Of course, it's some like weaselly man saying that. And I'm like, you don't understand what she did here, I don't think. Like, she's not just like this beautiful, she's not just this way, because I'm like, she's acting. Everything you're seeing is her acting. Like, it's very difficult to portray this kind of character with this nuance. And I think she does such an incredible job here. And she really disturbs us here. And another tidbit from the scene was that David Lynch talks about there was in his childhood, he saw him and his brother witnessed a naked woman walking down the street and instantly knew something was wrong.
Yeah, and his brother burst into tears.
Yes, and like that was a very formative experience for him. Like just they knew that this nudity was not, it wasn't sexual or playful, it was disturbing and something was very wrong.
Yeah, and it also is, you know, David Lynch repeats this scene in other works like Ronette. Mm-hmm. She walks along the train tracks, like beat up and
tattered, naked.
Yeah. So this was obviously like a really pivotal moment for him in his childhood. So they take her into the car and she looks completely forlorn, but she recognizes Jeffrey, and Sandy kind of starts to see the relationship that they have. And when they get in Sandy's house, you know, they're like, call an ambulance. And she's like leaning on him and she's like, my secret lover.
And Sandy's like, what?
Sandy watches in horror and she's like, he put this disease in me. And we're like, is she talking about Frank? Is she talking about Jeffrey?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very disturbing. I know we've said that word a million times in this episode, right, but it truly is.
And Sandy's just like, wait, what's happening?
I know, she's crying. Laura Dern is such a good actress.
She really is. And she was 18 here. I was like, God, she's so good.
She's in hysterics.
Some Nepo babies deserve it. Isabella and Laura Dern.
Right.
Two of the ones that do.
She can't handle this. She's like this high schooler witnessing this, as you said, a beautiful mommy boy dynamic. She doesn't understand what's happening. My interpretation is, it's like this invasion of this middle class bourgeois sensibility. Like the sexual chaos is like invading the middle class idyllic space. And Sandy is seeing a different side of Jeffrey, that he's like a man with a sexual inner life.
Yeah, I think that's something that's so interesting too. This like the class interplay here, and like the, I mean, Sandy is just so naive, and like what Jeffrey is going through in this whole movie is kind of his own journey to a place of less naivete than he had before, and
spurred by the injury, the and the illness of a parent.
Exactly. Yeah, the loss, this loss of innocence.
Yeah.
And Sandy clearly hasn't experienced that. How could she have any context for what's going on?
I mean, she's got this like pink bedroom.
So cute.
It's like a pink girly room. She's on the phone with Jeffrey, and she's like, tells him she loves him. And she's like, where is my dream? To which I wanted to be like, I know you think it's sweet. And I'm like, shut up.
I like me empathizing with the baby girl.
Like, she's so privileged, and like meanwhile Dorothy is like battered, and she's
totally
like, my dream.
I think her naivete, her innocence is not her fault, you know, in some way. And then I feel empathy for both. But yeah, I can understand. You're like, grow up.
Jeffrey sneaks back into Dorothy's apartment and sees Gordon, the yellow man, standing there with blood, like a head injury, with blood pouring from his skull, and but still alive. And the husband of Dorothy is shot dead and earless in a chair. The police are shooting at Frank's building. This romantic, very 50s music plays as Jeffrey considers the scene, and he decides to let them find the scene on their own. He no longer needs to be involved in this case. You said that the room's energy is like this, almost like a Black Lodge kind of air.
Yeah, I compare it to that, just in the sense, especially in like the sound design and like this like otherworldly, like this frozen scene with the yellow man being his parts of his brain exposed. You're like, this isn't supposed to be happening. This isn't real, but it's real and it is happening. This otherworldly, other realm, basically.
Mm-hmm. So to walk me through the ending here in this apartment,
Well, the well-dressed man. Well-dressed man is walking the apartment building from the stairs. Jeffrey, sees him as he is leaving via the stairwell. And he's like, oh, shit, I've got to run back up to the apartment. He's been seen. He's being followed now. What we didn't necessarily know before was that Frank is disguised as the well-dressed man. I love that David Lynch characterizes things like the yellow man, the
well-dressed man,
the one-armed man.
Yeah.
There's these ways of characterizing things.
It's very noir.
It is, totally. Yeah, the archetypal or stereotypical characters. So Jeffrey goes back up into the apartment. He's got a police radio on him, and he calls to Sandy's father, who's there, you know, outside the building. I'm in the bedroom. I'm hiding under the bed. Da 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 da. And he realizes that Frank also has a police radio. And he's like, oh, fuck. So he goes, he hides back in the closet. He changes his hiding place. Frank enters into the apartment. He's like, says something along the lines of like, you fucking idiot. Like, I've also got a radio. I'm going to get you. You know?
Yeah. Just, the boogeyman at this point.
Totally. He's geared up. He doesn't acknowledge the half alive zombie figure and the dead body of Don. Just bleeding out slowly and kind of, you know, they're a little still life over there, barely moving.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's like very stage-like.
It is. And so Frank goes up into the bedroom to blow him away, takes some shots, and he's like, where the fuck are you? So Jeffrey, as Frank is freaking out, Jeffrey comes out of the closet quickly, takes the still bleeding yellow man's gun. He goes back in the closet. Frank comes back out. He's just fucked up. He shoots the yellow man down. He's pissed off. And this apartment at this point is, I mean, throughout the movie, to me, it was very much like a stage set, like where you can see everything. You've got this long hallway. It's, you know, where what we're seeing is very purposeful, and we don't ever, you know, we don't see, the only time we see the bedroom is for a moment when Jeffrey walks in there with the police radio. And yeah, that we talked about, like the it being filmed on anamorphics. I think it just shows you everything. Nothing is really hidden there. Frank comes to the closet, and as he opens the closet, Jeffrey pops him right in the head. And right away, Sandy and her detective father enter right after. And Sandy's father says, it's all over now, you know?
Now it's dark.
Now it's dark. And it's like, really? Is it all over now? I mean, I love that Frank gets popped in the face by Jeffrey. He's such a good boy for that.
Yes.
He stands up to this metaphorical darkness. And then Julie Cruz comes back. The lovers are reunited. The horror is abated. They're making out in the hallway next to the crime scene.
So perverse.
Love that.
And then we go into the ear. There's a close-up of the inner bit of an ear.
Exactly.
And we pull out to see Jeffrey's peaceful face as he wakes up in his yard.
Another portal.
Everything's restored. It's sunny and bright. There's a robin above him chirping on a branch.
Animatronic robin.
Yeah.
Love.
Yes. He's with Sandy at their house. His father is healed. This mechanical robin brings a worm to the windowsill, and it's like, the American dream is restored. Yeah, they say again, it's a strange world, isn't it? The firefighter rides by again on his truck waving. His child wears a little party hat. We see Dorothy watching him from a park bench.
And he comes and hugs his mother. It's this beautiful scene. Like, everything's good now.
Yeah.
Baby and mommy reunited, but there's a twinge of something on her face. You're like, what the?
Mommy was scarred.
Yes.
And Lynch told a French interviewer, this is the subject of Blue Velvet. You apprehend things, and when you try to see what it's all about, you have to live with it.
Mm. Apt.
And I still can see Blue Velvet through. Cheers. That's the end of Blue Velvet.
Pan up into the trees, blue sky above, and then it fades to crush Blue Velvet curtain. And the scene is done. It's a play. The whole thing is a play.
Yeah.
I love this movie.
I do too.
I get so much out of it every time I watch it. And the last time I had seen this before we prepared for this episode was at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland. And I went to a 9:45 p.m. special showing, and I was like, I'm going to watch. This is going to be awesome. I was on a couch. I fell asleep in the first 10 minutes of the movie, and I woke up to screaming, which was probably one of my favorite watches of this movie, because I woke up and I was like so disturbed. It really added to everything for me. And I think that's how we should all really watch it. Just half asleep, in and out, maybe on drugs. Who knows? Really. You can watch this movie
so many ways. Like, even watching it like in the middle of the day, completely sober for my notes. Mm. I was like, this is just so good. Yes. Like, it's just, it's a wonderful film. And that's why we took so long talking about it. This will probably come out in two parts because we talked for 3 hours. Oopsie.
I love talking to you about it. You're so fun to talk to.
Yeah, this was so fun.
I love giving the I give like a baby brain analysis. You give like the actual in-depth meat the academics analysis.
No, you had lots to say. So I think we'll end there, Gar.
Okay, mommy. What a fun time. I had a blast. I want to keep talking.
I know. Well, come back on the show.
Precious and warm my memory through.